Breakfast puppies?
We're all set to begin, so let's dive right in to Bikers, Dice, and Bars. Talking bicycles and motorbikes, gamer things and all the like. You can listen to it in your cars, but mostly it's about dive bars. Bikers, Dice, and Bars.
Hey, Linsel, what are we drinking tonight?
We are going to drink a little taster platter of three different ports, including a local hazelnut option made by Treos and a 20-year Copkeep.
I'm really looking forward to that one. So we're starting with the local lot one?
Yes, it's Treos. It is a hazelnut dessert wine, not technically a port because it is not made in Portugal.
Cheers, gentlemen.
Oh, cheers, gentlemen.
Cheers.
Welcome to Bikers, Dice, and Bars. Once again, I am Nathaniel, a.k.a. NPC, and sitting to my left, as usual,
just Jacob.
And Dr. Xander Gerrymander.
And we have with us today a very special guest. Introduce yourself.
I am Linsel Green, former bartender at Portland's former smallest brewery, Tugboat Brewing.
Wasn't it also the oldest?
It was the oldest owner-operated brew pub in Portland.
All right.
While it was
still awesome.
Running. Well, our plan this episode is once we've made it an hour through talking about various topics and are good and drunk on port, is to hopefully give the Tugboat a podcast eulogy. I think we all miss it. Mm. I think pretty much everyone here has fond memories of that place. So we'll get to that at some point, though, but it's good to have you in the studio, Linsel. You are actually someone that I've been talking about getting in here since we started.
That's true.
Because exactly. One of the topics that Xander put on our big old planning list was eulogy for a dead bar, or talk about dead dive bars or something. And it's like, man, I would love to give a eulogy to the Tugboat.
Yeah.
But first, we talk about more happy things.
So for our wine right here, it says, savor the bounty of Oregon with our luscious Willamette Valley grapes infused with roasted hazelnuts and aged in oak for over 18 months. Delicate sweetness, rich with fruit and hazelnut flavors, make this an enchanting wine to sip after a great meal.
It is delicious.
Produced and bottled in Monmouth, Oregon.
Oh, Monmouth.
Probably the best thing to come out of Monmouth in recent memory.
I strongly disagree.
Oh, really?
For two reasons. A, that's where I saw the eclipse. And B, I saw it in, do you guys know the amazing Abraham Lincoln impersonator that lives in town?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. You've not seen Sexy Abe?
No.
Abraham Lincoln.
Abraham Lincoln. I ran into him by accident on a bus. It's like, oh my God. He was wearing a t-shirt and some jeans. And yeah. He had the Abraham Lincoln beard.
Ow. Hold on. I'm going to have to show you a picture
I can't
right
say
now.
That I
we'll
have...
definitely put a picture of Abraham in our show
because
notes.
Because he's a great guy.
But Xander, you said the eclipse is a good thing about Monmouth.
I saw it there.
Linsel specifically said to come out of Monmouth. I would say that the eclipse more or less
came out of space.
Through.
Yeah, that's true. But Abraham Lincoln currently lives there, and he set us up in his Civil War reenactment tent in his backyard.
Wow.
And picked us up and dropped us off at the train station because we took the train down to avoid traffic because we're not dumb.
Well, that guy is, that's something else. You got to watch the eclipse with Abraham Lincoln?
Yeah.
Right on. I'll click to that.
Nice.
He's someone that we should try and get on here at some point. We have so many interesting...
Ooh, Civil War cocktails. I'm on it.
We have so many interesting local weirdos and icons and just interesting, unique characters.
He's also super, super into board games. His entire house is full of games.
Oh, ooh. Yeah. Let's do it. Let's get him on. I'd also like to one day maybe get the Unipiper on. I'd love to chat with that guy. Or the local samurai biker guy who rides around town in full samurai armor with like a flag attached to his bike.
I haven't seen him.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah, I haven't seen him in a while.
Portland.
I haven't seen him in a while, but I've seen him a few times. And okay, I want to take this back to something that you said, Linsel. Mm. So this is not a true port. I don't know anything about ports, so tell us why.
Well, my understanding is that certainly if somebody is a strictly defining port, my understanding is that true port comes from Portugal. And if it's not from Portugal, just like if it's not from the Champagne region of France, calling it Champagne is apparently not what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to call it sparkling wine. And in this situation, this is a dessert wine as opposed to a port because it's made in Monmouth.
That is the right of it. There are some ports from the Spanish side of the border that are grandfathered in because of...
border shifting.
Well, there's that whole Napoleonic Iberian Peninsula campaign that shook things up a bit. But yeah, that's basically the reason why some are port and some are dessert wine.
But ultimately, the flavors are really what's important. Labels are meaningless when it comes down to it.
We actually do have a third port that we did not mention.
Oh, yes.
That is one that I have brought from the Quinette Wines. It's the 2011 Boiler House Port from Columbia Valley.
A good name.
Yeah. This, and we featured Quinette Wines before when we had Spencer from the Sunshine Mill join us. So I always love to throw them a little bit more recognition. I'm actually going to go see them Saturday.
Nice. Ooh.
So hopefully they will, welcome us in and maybe showers or free stuff. That'd be nice. Please sponsor us. Anyway, let's take this to the road.
So subtle.
Now let's take this to the road. Jacob?
So tonight, because our guest happens to be a fellow recumbent rider, topic of the evening we're going to start with is all about recumbent bikes. Mm. So what do you ride, Linzel?
I ride an easy sport long wheelbase recumbent. It looks a bit like a long chopper. It's got full handlebars, not like under the seat steering or anything crazy like that. It's a real beast, and it's got an EcoSport, like first generation electric motor on it that I got over a decade ago, actually. It's still rolling.
Now, is your model Easy Bike one of the ones that has the square profile main bar?
Yeah, okay. Very much. It's definitely something that I've been riding for a long time. I used to commute on it all the time and ride around town. It was actually my primary mode of transit for years.
So for those who don't know, can we go and get a definition of what a recumbent bike is? We probably have all seen them, but we might not know what they're called.
Well, recumbent bicycles come in a couple different varieties, but generally speaking, the definition is you are lying or sitting backwards rather than positioned directly above the pedals.
So you're not sitting in like a full upright position like on a normal bicycle.
Correct.
Feet forward.
And the reason why I ended up getting one is because I'm a large dude, close to 300 pounds. And as a result, sitting on a normal saddle on a bicycle is just not a comfortable thing for a guy like me.
I'm not even that big, and I hate sitting on a normal saddle. I've even gotten like a custom fit saddle for my bicycle. Yeah. I have two bicycles, and I swap the saddle between them when I go for a ride because it's the best saddle I've ever sat on. And it still hurts like hell. Yeah. It just gets me right there in the tailbone.
Whereas I've got like a foot wide, cushy padding seat that I can put my entire weight on and never be uncomfortable. It's kind of wonderful.
So why I ended up riding a recumbent is I had a drunk driver who hit me a number of years ago. Ooh. And
asshole.
Due to some damage to my pelvis, I can no longer ride a standard bicycle for more than about 15 minutes without pain.
Yeah.
What I ride is a Velocity Max Series Expedition Pro, which is a high wheeler. My wheelbase is about the same length as a regular bicycle's, and my wheels are the same size.
Nice.
And they're 720s. So my feet are really high up in the air.
Yeah, I'm sure that when you're stopping at a light, you've got to put a foot down or you fall over.
Don't have an option on that.
Yeah.
On the flats, I can get up to a really good clip, but going uphill, it's basically doing leg presses the entire way up.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's the nature of a recumbent. Unlike a normal bicycle, you can't stand in the pedals. There's no ability to use your own weight to your advantage.
Now, have either of you or any of you ridden a recumbent that is also hand-driven?
Yes.
Those look ridiculous.
I mean, standards, sir.
I understand that some people don't have the same kind of use of their legs, and so a hand crank, or they want to maximize their hand-arm workout, but the idea of a hand crank bicycle to me seems ridiculous.
So I have ridden two different ones. One was a true hand crank where there was no foot option.
Yeah.
The other one was called a dual drive.
What?
Which means that
Both? Which means that you got five guys drinking beer all pedaling at the same time, right?
No.
Oh, we're not talking about those bikes.
No, no, no.
Okay.
This one meant
bikes suck.
That both the hand cranks and the foot cranks drove the bicycle. They both provided motive power.
Hmm.
And on that particular model, the primary force was from your feet and the secondary was from your hands. The primary drive chain came off the feet, and there was just basically a pickup gear midline that drove the hands.
That sounds like magic.
It was a mechanical marvel.
So I believe that in one of our first episodes, I very ignorantly made fun of recumbent bikes, and I didn't realize that, I mean, at least, you know, for someone like you, for example, that it was used because you had gotten disabled by some asshole on the road. And I didn't realize that most people who probably had them had reasons like that behind it. I just thought they're just ridiculous looking. And so for everyone who listened to those first episodes, I apologize for my ignorance. Very much so.
Did you get like backlash from the recumbent community?
No, it wasn't that. It was more that I didn't realize that was the reason. And I felt bad because I had ignorance in me.
I will say in your defense, you very quickly mea culpa'd once we started talking about it.
No, so absolutely.
We've already tread that ground.
Yeah, I know. But I just felt like I needed to say it again.
And let's be real. Most of the guys, because it's primarily guys, but not exclusively, the former owner of Coventry Cycle Works was a very proud recumbent rider.
Absolutely.
And she was an awesome recumbent racer. If you were to diss on their recumbents, their reaction would be like, oh, okay.
I suppose you have a point.
I guess you don't really see any recumbent bike clubs around town, right?
Like, there are three, actually.
I'm sure that there exists.
There are.
Well, no. I bet in Portland you do.
Yeah.
But I don't think there's anywhere else in this country where there's a recumbent bike club.
Never heard of the Relinquents?
There are some communities that are hubs for recumbents. There's a couple places down in Arizona, New Mexico, which I don't understand. I mean, like, the hills around here are just god-awful on a recumbent. I can't imagine New Mexico.
You'd think the recumbents would be much more popular in places like Kansas and Nebraska, where everything's flat. Because ultimately, recumbents really excel when they're on the flats.
So I'd like to turn this over to you, Lynn, so to get a little bit of feedback on your experience as a recumbent rider. Specifically, did you ever find that there was a stigma against it with active cyclists?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, as a regular commuter on a recumbent, and especially an electrified recumbent, I had a lot of situations where Portland's sort of more spandex-clad culture bumped up against me a little bit. And part of that is because I think anytime you've got an electrified vehicle that you're riding, somebody who doesn't kind of views you as cheating. But ultimately, the fact is that, I weigh 300 pounds. My bike weighed close to 100 pounds, given all of the gear on it. It also had a stereo built into it. and as a result, going up a hill was the kind of thing that you just had to have electric. Otherwise, you're just spinning, trying to get up those hills. Mm-hmm. And there were lots of times where I'd start at a red light with another biker next to me, and the biker would assume that they would take off faster than me, and I'd just put down the throttle and sort of take off. And then at the next light, I get these dirty looks of like, right. Oh, you're not really biking. You're not a real biker.
I hate that so much. We talked about how we hate the whole people looking down on each other.
Holier than thou art.
Because their two wheels are better than your two wheels.
Sure.
Like back when we talked about the wave in our first episode, motorcyclists will do this wave. I never see cyclists do it. But at least there's that spirit of camaraderie. Like, we're all on two wheels together. Mm-hmm. Occasionally, you get either the sport bike rider or that really old douchey Harley rider who just won't wave at you.
Mm-hmm.
But for the most part, you know, bikers are like, hey, we're all in this together. Hey, two wheels, bro, ride on. Good for you. Whereas cyclists do the opposite. They're like, well, my bike is better than yours. Oh, fuck off.
The competition inherent in riding a
who can be the
what
most
the British
eco.
Would call a push bike.
Mm-hmm.
The
for the love of God, you're riding a really expensive child's toy.
That whole culture of, well, your bike did not require you to take out a mortgage like mine did. Mm-hmm. So you're not cool.
Well, and in this town, the nature of theft is such that having a high price bike seems like a really poor choice in a lot of ways.
Well, I mean, even having had a number of low-cost bikes just completely either stolen or disassembled or parts of it taken, you know, I'm like, well, cool. There goes my week of pay.
I do want to bring it back to when you were talking about how you required an electric motor to essentially assist you up the hills.
Yeah.
I am extremely asthmatic. Even on a regular bicycle, I have a hard time going up hills. And there's this one particular hill on the way from on the way home from the max stop to my house that is very difficult. It's a very high hill. And in order to get up it, I frequently have to get off and wheeze my way up walking the bike. Twice on that commute home with my bicycle, walking it up, clutching my chest, clearly in pain, I've had douchey cyclists speed past me and yell at me like, you should be riding it, bro. Fuck you. I hate that douchey cyclist culture.
Yep.
That Portland just breeds.
The key is to walk up hills that don't have a bike path on them. So then you don't have those bikers ride by you giving you a hard time. You got to walk up the hills where there's no bikes involved. Then you're invisible. Nobody will even notice you or comment.
That's a good call. I'm going to try that next time.
The key to biking is avoiding other bikers.
Yes, yes, yes.
Which is funny because it's the month of Pedalpalooza.
Oh, that's right.
Let's bring it to another topic you brought up, which is the electric motor.
Sure.
Electric bikes are a little bit notorious in this town, increasingly so now that all of those rental electric scooters are coming in.
Yeah.
But electric scooters.
They're going to pull the California thing and start having rental scooters available that are electric that people can poodle around town on and kind of leave in different places.
The orange bikes weren't enough.
Yeah.
I get mixed feelings on it. Some might say that they are a great solution to the concept of the last mile of travel, where, you know, you're going from your home to another city and you don't want to take cabs or Uber around, but you have this convenient way to kind of zip around. You know, I could see it, but the electric bikes have a big stigma against them, probably bigger than recumbents. This town, sort of the bike mavens, hate the electric bikes because they go on the bike paths and they, you know, they cause a stir and you can hear them coming by. And again, you have those cyclists that are like, you're not on a true bike. You're not really doing it.
I mean, that's a truism. A friend of mine is the owner of Field Electric. It's one of the earliest dedicated electric bicycle shops in Portland. Used to be on 39th across from Fred Meyer. Now it's up by Portland Community College Southeast Campus. I was in the shop one day, and this guy walks in pushing a bike and goes, hey, man, do you have a tube for this particular size? Obviously, he had a flat tire. We could see the flat tire. Spencer goes, yeah, give me a minute. I'll grab it out of back. And the guy is looking around and realizes he's in an electric bike shop and goes, screw this. I'm going over to Fred Meyer. And wheels his bike out.
What the hell?
Ow. You have to be pretty hardcore.
It'll be a cold day in the hell before I give money to a local shop over a big chain.
That's right.
Electronic bike bastards.
Oh, God. That is the ultimate, like, Portland douchebag dilemma.
Yeah, it was a treat. Spencer walked out with the tube. The guy had already left. And I'm laughing. Just laughing. And he goes, what? Well, what happened? What happened? Where did he go?
I'm just trying to help you.
Yeah. I was going to offer to change it for him.
You know, I will say that as a recumbent rider, one of the issues that I do face is finding a good place to repair a bicycle. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned Coventry earlier, which is where I purchased my bike a long time ago.
Where I purchased mine.
And certainly they do fantastic repair work on recumbents, but they're quite a distance from my home.
And they're closed now.
Oh, are they?
Yeah.
Oh, well, they're even farther from my home then. As a result, you know, taking your recumbent, like a long heavy bike to a local shop, like in my neighborhood, Mississippi Bike Works is where I tend to go. And those guys, when you wheel in, they have this look of horror on their face. It's like, oh no, like our rack is not really built to hold this beast.
Yeah.
I mean, it's probably not though. Like that's the thing.
Where do you take such a bike for repairs without getting that experience?
So as far as shops in Portland, there's two. I am spacing the name. Recumbent PDX, which went into the same location that Coventry used to be.
Fair enough.
Which is 21st and Hawthorne. And then the other one is Rose City Recumbent, which is on Powell and roughly 36th. However, the best thing to do is do a Google search for Portland Recumbent Bicycle Mechanic. There are multiple individuals all over the town, many of whom used to be Coventry employees, who are working out of their garage or doing a come-to-you service thing.
Sure.
Now, they'll also work on regular bikes, but they have the chops to work on a recumbent.
I do like that we have a number of mobile bike repairmen.
Mm-hmm. It's pretty cool. Town.
Just dial someone and they'll come to your house, work on your shit, and leave. And they don't charge that much.
Yeah, pretty reasonable.
One of the things that I was sad to see didn't get off the ground, I had two acquaintances who were trying to do it. They were trying to contract with or make arrangements with some of the bigger corporations like downtown, where they could come into the like parking lot or wherever the bike storage for the business was, and for a nominal fee, just bang out a whole bunch of maintenance services on everybody's bike while it was hanging.
We actually have a service that does that exact thing at my office.
That's awesome.
My office downtown, we have a bike shop in the office. It's pretty cool. We do bike fittings there. We have one of those big old stands to hold the bike up on.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, it's pretty awesome.
Yeah.
It's a great benefit.
And we do have people that will come in. They'll contract. We have a physical therapist, a bicycle physical therapist, pedal PT. They'll come in and do bike fittings.
That's pretty amazing.
Wow. Yeah, they're like, hey, bring your bike in and we'll help you fit it better so you have less problems riding it. We have people who come in and do tune-ups and all kind of things.
I feel like that's the equivalent of having a barber in your office building.
It kind of
is.
You know,
you're like, oh, yeah. You know what? My bike's a little squeaky. Can you work on it while I'm in the office?
We also have...
That's so good, though.
We also have a rack full of doggy leashes, multiple doggy bowls. It's very much a Portland office.
I was going to say, that sounds incredibly Portland.
Could be on that show.
So going back to the electric paradigm, so you have a full drive electric, right?
I do. I mean, obviously, the pedals have their own tie-in, and then the electric motor has a separate chain that runs to the pedals, or rather to the actual gears. And as a result, I can drive with power without any pedaling at all if I desperately need to, but not at speed. So mostly it's a pedal assist.
Right.
And that's partially just because it's as old as it is. More modern electric motors really allow for a bicycle to be driven almost with no pedaling whatsoever.
So just out of curiosity, with an electric bike, and the legality of using an electric motor while in a bike lane, doesn't it make you a mechanized vehicle at that point? Do you have to be in, like, what's the...
I will link in a very special link to a PDF in our show notes that breaks down all of those by Oregon state law. But Jacob?
Yeah, I mean, roughly, it falls under the weird... So here's the thing.
Good question, right?
Yeah. It depends where you are. Because under Oregon state law, there's a basic set of rules. And then on top of that is layered municipal code. Like, for instance, in some municipalities in Oregon, you can drive a scooter of below, I think it's
49.5.
49. Mm-hmm. Actually, I think it's lower than that.
I think it's 49 cc's or higher means you need a license.
Right.
Like a license.
Yeah. Yeah,
somewhere around there.
Yeah, but it's roughly the 49 point. You can drive those in a motorcycle lane.
Hmm.
Right, not motorcycle, lane? Bicycle lane.
Bicycle lane.
Where are these mystical lanes?
Motorcycle lane. Holy smokes.
I am on board with this.
Living the dream. Motorcycle lanes.
Yes. But so that's the thing. And electrics, I mean, the one thing I know for certain, partially because of the Bicycle Transportation Alliance here in Portland, a lot of the rules in the state that are relative to electric motors on bicycles were written back when most electric motors were power assisters rather than full drives.
We just brought up a new organization here, the Bicycle Transportation Alliance.
Alliance.
BTA. Do we hate them too, or do we like them?
I am not a fan.
Oh, really? Okay.
Well, I'm not quite ready to say fuck them, BTA. But definitely fuck Peabot.
Just fuck Peabot. Just in case they were wondering whether or not we didn't like them.
Yeah, no, fuck those guys.
Yes.
Those guys put in the dumbest barricade on my bike thoroughfare on Ankeny and 15th, I think it is.
Oh, my God.
And they just, it went from, you know, a regular full, you know, greenway lane, which is nice and lovely. You just kind of bike it at your leisure. And then put in these giant concrete barriers to make it so bikes can only go single file to prevent cars from driving through, but only on that one spot. Mm-hmm. Nowhere else on Ankeny is there anything like this.
At Ankeny and 20th, they have that weird...
They have the weird barrier, but yeah. That's like a little, it's like a small little curb in the middle of the
road. Everybody drives over it anyway.
Yeah, of course. Dick.
So
they put the giant concrete thing there.
I fucking hate Ankeny.
Ankeny is a nightmare. And then within like 2 days, it's completely full of tagging stickers. It looks awful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They did the... I live just off of Clinton, and they did two of those below 39th on Clinton, and they're just god-awful. And, I mean, all I can say is...
Fuck Peabot.
Fuck Peabot.
You know what? Fuck Peabot. That was really the thought I had in my mind, which is, you know, fuck Peabot.
Oh, Peabot.
Any last words on electric bikes and recumbents?
So aside from assistance in going up hills and things like that, and obviously it's not as hard on your legs, what's the benefit of an electric bike over a traditional bike? Why would you want one?
Well, I can certainly answer that, especially once you put a front fairing, the sort of windshield on the front of on a recumbent bicycle, you have a lot more streamlining. And as a result, you can travel quite a bit faster. And as an example of that, back in the day when I used to ride with the Zoo Bombers who regularly ride down from the Oregon Zoo down through Washington Park down towards downtown. Certainly back in the day, we used to ride down Highway 26, actually. Yeah. they refer to it as the Hellway.
Right.
And on my long wheelbase recumbent, I managed to get up to 54 miles an hour on that downhill stretch. It's only for about a half a mile or three quarters of a mile that you actually ride on the highway.
That's one mega clinched butthole there.
I was going so fast that I have a speedometer on the front of my bike, but I was too scared to look at it while I was riding. And it was only when I got to the bottom of the hill that I was able to check my highest speed that I saw that it was 54. And at that point, I decided to name the bike the Sammy Hagar because it could not go 55.
Right. I took a buddy's high wheeler like mine out for a test ride before I got mine. His was set up with a lot more bells and whistles. Mine's about as bog simple as you can get. He had one of the stretch cloth rear fairings, which actually make more difference on a recumbent than the front fairing does. On the flat, I hit 42 miles an hour, not even trying. I was like whipping down the street and I was like, wow.
So they offer a level of streamlining, which really, I mean, all of the land-based bicycle speed records are all on recumbents.
Mm-hmm.
Point.
Think of it like the difference between skateboarding, longboarding, and then street luge. One of those is much faster than the other.
Yeah. Okay.
You know? Yeah.
I actually riding my high rider, my high wheeler, I do describe it as it's a lot like street luge, except you're 3 feet off the ground.
Now bringing this to the gaming table, which we are all currently sitting at my gaming table, we have switched up the wine. We have moved to the Quinette 2011 Boiler House Port from Columbia Valley. Reading the back. We have chosen to make camp on the banks of the Columbia River at the place the local Indians call Quinette, which means steelhead. We will call this camp Rock Fort.
You know, the real question I have about that is, how did the Indians have a word for steel?
I don't know.
I mean, I'm just saying.
I don't know.
I'm just going to point out that the word is their word for that type of fish.
Fair enough. Fair enough.
It's not a direct translation. Actually,
that's the joke.
Not like the native term is steelhead.
Well, anyway, we've switched to the Quinette wort. What do you guys think of this so far?
Delicious. It's definitely got a little bit more life on the tongue. It kind of sparks a little bit more. The last port was a little smoother, I feel like. This one definitely is a little more kind of...
The paper describes this as a luxurious blend of Tintacao, Tempranillo, Sussao, and Torriga Nacional.
Ooh.
Well, that I don't means know what nothing that means. To me.
Torriga Nacional is a grape varietal that is originally from a specific region of Portugal.
And so, I thought that was a Spanish political party.
It very well might be.
It actually led to the political party. Enough of the drink.
Well, I think they're trying to make port great again. And on that note, we're actually going to talk about some games. Now, specifically... We're going to talk about something that we haven't brought up yet in this podcast, which is board games. You know, board games is a huge, huge scope of conversation. There's so many freaking board games.
Oh, my God. Monopoly and Clue.
Oh, we can get both of those at the same party. We're going to have a riot.
Hey, hey, I can bring Golden Girls Clue.
Wait, Golden Girls Clue?
Yes.
So are the properties like the characters from Golden Girls or places that they went?
So did Sophia kill Dorothy at the senior center with the...
You think anybody's going to take Betty White?
Yeah.
You think anybody's going to be able to take Betty White?
B. Arthur runs the community chess. How does
Betty White is Rose. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I don't know. We'll have to get my sweetie Amanda on the mics because it's her game.
So right now, we're going to narrow this conversation topic down. Just like role-playing games are huge and vast, and there's so many different things that we could cover. We're going to focus in for our first ever board game chat on co-op board games. They are something that I'm very fond of. And I know from the conversations leading up to this episode that Linsel has been playing a lot of them as well.
Well, I have to say, actually, that the part of the reason why I've made the shift to co-op games and, you know, as a young college gamer, I certainly cut my teeth on a lot of competitive games. I played a lot of Wiz War and Cosmic Encounter when I was a kid.
Both wonderful games.
Fantastic games that have since been reinvented. But once I met my now wife, she's not as competitively minded. And like my attempt to bring Sounds Magic familiar. The Gathering to that table was a failure. I was not a fan. But once co-op gaming came up, it very quickly became a way for the two of us to play games together and for her to enjoy it more. And as a result, I found that I have enjoyed it a lot more as well. It's been a bit of a renaissance for me as a gamer to play games where we're working together against a board game or sort of a rudimentary AI.
What are current games that are popular?
Well, I can't speak to what's popular as a whole, but I will say that one of our favorites is a game called The Captain is Dead, which we picked up via Kickstarter.
Yeah.
It sort of simulates a Star Trek-style bridge where everybody plays a different role on board the ship. And, of course, the very first thing that happens is the captain is killed. And so, as a result, the rest of the crew is thrown into chaos trying to put out fires and resolve the problems that led to the captain's death and get themselves to safety. And it's kind of a nice way to work as a group together against essentially a deck of cards, which is coming up with obstacles for you.
So this is not a game where a power struggle ensues and everyone's trying to actually go and backstab each other and take control of the helm.
You know, I'm really, really happy that the creator of that game didn't try to incorporate some sort of a betrayal mechanic, because I feel like a lot of board games these days try and utilize some... hidden role or sneaky thing so that one of the players maybe has some kind of a betrayal component to it.
And just to give a quick breakdown, if you're not familiar with the concept of the betrayal mechanic, it usually takes place in a game that begins as a cooperative game. The popular one, this is not the first one, but the popular one is Betrayal at House on the Hill. And you start off, you're all working together loosely. You take turns until at some point the game...
steps in
The game states that one of you is now the betrayer.
Mm-hmm.
And then that player is now forced into an arbitrary role. They're suddenly working against the rest of the players. Problem is, all of their actions are basically scripted and might as well not have been a player in the first place.
Right.
To me, it's a kind of a hokey, poor mechanic. Yeah. And it breaks the spirit of what a co-op game, to me, should be.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, certainly there's lots of other co-op games that include a betrayal mechanic. Shadows over Camelot comes to mind as one of the first games I ever played where one of the players might be working against.
Dead of Winter and its expansions. Each
I feel like
chance.
That's not even co-op Dead of Winter.
Yeah.
Just each player trying to kill everybody else, get away with doing something.
Battlestar Galactica.
Classic. But so tough to bring to the table.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's the problem with a lot of these larger games where you have groups of people who are working together and then somebody who's a betrayer is that every time you try and bring that to the table, you're taking the risk that the person who's going to become the betrayer is the least experienced person at the table. And that's a real problem.
It seems like to have that role specifically, you'd need to be really well versed in, you know, subterfuge and any kind of those types of mechanics where if you're not so good at that, it seems like it'd fall apart real quick.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like the key with a lot of these kinds of games is that you need to have people who've played them. You know, ultimately, the first time through any kind of game where you're co-op, if there's a player who's less experienced, then much of the time that they're playing, they're going to be taking instruction from the other players who are more experienced.
They that does really suck, especially with games like Pandemic.
Oh, yeah. God. Oh,
Pandemic, man, so is common. To me the worst offender of that, where you just have one player calling the shots.
Yeah, I mean, Shadow over Innsmouth is potentially worse, but generally speaking, yeah, I agree with that. The other thing I don't like is cooperative board games that have the backdoor winner mechanic, where...
Oh, you know, yeah, terrible. Yeah.
Where, I mean, if you're going to make a cooperative board game, make a cooperative board game. Don't make it where one person wins more than everybody else.
That you're like, it's just lazy game design. It's like, I want to appeal to everyone, and I don't know what my game's about. I hate that so much.
Yeah, I feel like the urge to come up with a winner in games that don't need a winner mm-hmm. is always a real problem for me. And that's true in larger party games, too. Things like Apples to Apples or Super Fight games where you have large groups of people participating. And then the idea that somebody's got to come away a winner from a game like right. that just seems like it's...
I feel like with those types of party games, though, I don't really care who wins. My friends don't care who wins. We're just there to have laughs and then take pictures of the hilarious card combinations we come up with.
I don't think anybody even scores those games.
Well, that's the thing. There are some people who do. And I feel like those people are the same people who have problems with co-op gaming as well. Because if they don't come away with somebody who's a winner, they don't feel satisfied.
Yeah, those people shouldn't be playing with us.
Yeah, well, they don't. Yeah. They don't come to my game nights anymore.
What do you think about the cooperative games that are partially competitive, such as Last Night on Earth, where one player takes control of one side of the game, and then the rest of the players are playing together against that person?
The sort of asymmetric style.
I have no problem with that. Siege on the Citadel was a game of the favorite of mine in that genre. So
my only problem with, well, it's not necessarily the genre, but specifically with Last Night on Earth, is that I have a personal loathing of any game mechanic that denies you a turn.
Mm-hmm.
And Last Night on Earth, the zombie master has a number of cards which make that the one or more of the players don't get a turn. To me, at any game mechanic that says you no longer get to play or you don't get to play for a round is just wrong. I hate that. I hate that so much. Like, there's so many things that you can do to me in a role-playing game or a board game, but taking away my ability to play the game is the worst.
I feel like the best house rule for games like that is that whoever has had a turn eliminated gets to go in the back room and smoke weed.
And everybody has to put their weed in the back room.
Yeah. Right, exactly.
Yeah, okay. That's the thing.
You got to step away from the table.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I haven't had a lot of experience playing these types of board games, though they all sound awesome. The only game that I can think of that's somewhat similar in which there is some co-op aspects, but there's still kind of a winner at the end of it, was that game Zombies with the triple exclamation point. Oof. Where you kind of build the game as you go.
An old game, a classic.
Yeah.
Yeah, so you go and you build the
one plane. With the little green plastic zombies.
Yes. So many zombies.
So many zombies. But you build the game as you go, which is fun. But also you have to kind of co-op with other players as you go along too, because otherwise you're just going to get surrounded and die.
Yeah.
But the mechanic too at the end is the first person to make it to the helipad wins.
Right.
Yeah. But I don't really remember you backstabbing anybody in that game. Am I wrong about that? It's been a while since I played.
On your turn, you get to move the zombies.
Right.
Which means that you can screw someone over at the end.
But there isn't really a benefit in zombies to screwing someone over, because ultimately you win if everybody escapes. And if you end up leaving somebody behind, you still kind of win, but
not really.
That person loses.
I just don't think it's a very good game.
I'll agree that it's not a great game, even though I have a special place in my heart for that. But that game, the best way to win is to screw your neighbor as hard as possible by sending zombies after them and all of that. The key is to partner up for as long as possible and then be the one who times the fucking everybody else over perfectly.
What do you think about cooperative games with a timer?
I love them.
Space Alert or the, the Galaxy Trucker? Was that one?
Galaxy Trucker.
It's not co-op, but it does have a timing component to it, but it is not a co-op
game. But yeah, Space Alert's my favorite.
Space Alert, Escape from the Temple is another one that uses a recording as a way to have players sort of be working against that recording.
I think the licensed XCOM game does it with the app version of the same thing. Yeah.
There was a game that's name I'm forgetting, which was set in the Klondike Gold Rush. It had a timer component because you had to get a whole bunch of things done or winter was going to trap you in the past and you were dead.
Freeze to death.
I mean, it was like, I remember vividly the rules stating, if you do not complete all of your party's goals by the time the timer runs out, well, we all know what happened to the Donner Party.
You guys ever play Klondike Trail?
Never heard of it.
It was a playoff of the Oregon Trail, and the whole point was to go up to the Klondike during the Klondike Gold Rush, and the same concept where you had to like go and buy supplies along the way and face, you know, all these difficulties, with the exception that, unlike Oregon Trail, you know, if you made it to the end, like, you won and you got to go pioneer the state. Whereas in the Klondike Trail, you could go and face all of the perils that happened to you and then try to strike out a gold mine and get nothing. And then the game ended.
Wow, that's a really great review.
It was an honest review, and it was an honest game. Like, sometimes you go through all the peril, and then you get nothing.
You still freeze in the mountains and die.
Oh, do you mean the Yukon Trail?
Yukon Trail, that's what it was.
Sorry, Yukon Trail. No, that's fine. Yeah.
I'd like to give a shout out to a game that's currently on Kickstarter that I backed. It started a few days ago. I first played this game called Escape the Dark Castle, and it's a UK game that is inspired by text-based role-playing video games.
Ooh,
from back in the day, where it's like you have four choices, which do you do kind of thing. Mm. And it's got this classic style 1970s looking black and white, dirty, scurvy artwork. It is a game. It's a cooperative board game of up to four players. And you are all like the miller, the smith, the courtesan, the apothecary. You're just these people who are trying to escape from the dark castle. And escaping requires 15 turns. Now, each of your characters has a set of dice that you get to roll based on your character's abilities. And each turn, you flip. Okay, so you have this stack of scenario cards that you shuffle, and then you take the 15 out of them and set them down. You flip the first one, and it's like, you have stepped into this room. There is a strange merchant there with some unidentified meat being flayed over a thing. You have an opportunity to steal the meat from him. Do you... A, steal the meat, everybody roll X, and maybe you can get away with it. You heal something, but if you fail, then this happens. You have to fight him. Or B, just leave.
Hmm.
And it's enough. It's all these things. Sometimes you just have to fight someone and you have to roll a bunch of dice and you have to do some dice matching. You got to roll some symbols in your dice versus the monster's dice. You got to defeat it. It's brutal and hilarious and really flavorful. We played it at my buddy's birthday party last week, and we apparently were doing really well because we had made it through like 12 of the stacks and not taken any damage and had just been juggling items like, oh, we're full of items. Let's trade this out. Now we're at full health and we have the magic sword and whatever. And this dude was walking by. He's like, you guys are doing really well. Ridiculously well. You've got all the easy cards. I'm like, yeah, I guess we got the easy cards. We got to the second to last card. It was just some fucking piss hand. He's like, comes up to you and wants to fight you. What do? You can do this. You can give him some money. You can fight him. And we're all like, yeah, let's fuck him up. And then he kicked our asses. And then we almost died to the final boss. But it's a fantastic game. It's currently on Kickstarter. It's got 3 expansions now.
Nice.
I recommend you check it out.
So there is a subgenre to the backdoor winner style of cooperative play that I haven't seen done too much. The best example of it was actually a game that a friend of mine was working on, and I helped him along in the development process. For the purposes of that one, you were playing different members of the court of the Tokugawa shogunate, and your goal as a group of players was to prevent threats to the shogun and emperor, and each person's roles had special abilities and everything. However, sometimes using your special abilities would have negative consequences for other players, where it might be the best. Okay, so the head Shinto priest at court had the ability to try to get a public outpouring of support. However, that would undercut the merchant class and have a negative impact for one of the other courtiers. And so that's fun, where you can design cooperative games where what you do has a direct negative impact on someone else, but given it's all in the open and part of the difficulty is figuring out the short-term versus long-term benefits of whether or not... I really like it when games do that.
Yeah, it's not like you're screwing somebody else. Yeah, it's much more a matter of you're trying to balance what the best thing to do is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like, we have this limited resource, and I could use a power, but I gotta take a point from it. Sorry, guys, I'm gonna do it. It's gonna help us out in the long run, kind of thing.
Right. I remember on one of our playtests, we ended up with the... do you remember what the title for the deputy to the shogun was? The military deputy to the shogun.
I think they call it the military deputy to the shogun.
So anyways, the person playing that particular role ended up losing so much honor, he had to commit seppuku in order to stave off the overthrow of the shogunate.
One thing that I love about cooperative games is that there's rarely any hard feelings afterwards. Mm-hmm. It's a good game that you can play with people who might just not be good enough sports for something that's competitive. People who might realize, you know, I just don't like losing to someone. Mm-hmm. But I do like losing together.
Yeah.
I do like winning together. You feel like you work together as a team to outsmart someone, and that someone is the game designer.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Frequently in a co-op game, you're not playing against each other. You're playing against the person who wrote the game.
Very much.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
And if he kicks your ass, well, fortunately, he's not there to gloat about it.
Mm-hmm.
But if you kick his
he can't
ass,
be that guy.
You at least feel good together about it.
Yeah. And you have a real sense of revisionist history, too. One of my favorite co-op games is a game called Burgle Brothers. It's a heist game where everybody plays some kind of thief who's breaking into a building to try and steal a bunch of stuff.
Oh, and there's an app for this now, isn't there?
There is. I'm sure that there is a digital version of it. It's by Tim Fowers. It's a fantastic game that I got via Kickstarter. And the nature of the game is that on each floor of the building that you're breaking into, there are guards. And the guards have random movements that are drawn from their own stacks of cards. And the result is that you don't know where the guard is going next. And that means that every decision that you make in the game and every decision that the rest of your teammates make in the game, there's always this discussion of where should I go? Where can I go to be safe? And nobody knows because the guard deck is waiting to be revealed. And as a result, when the players lose that game, and I will say that probably 80 to 90% of the games that I played in Burgle Brothers have been failures, inevitably the guard catches somebody and then the game is over. And then there's this opportunity for revisionist history. What if we did this?
Yeah.
What if we, where was the guard gonna go? What right. if we did this? And even with my wife, sometimes there's the sort of, what if we didn't do that? And I went this other place instead, and we get the retcons where yeah, you're yeah, like, yeah. oh, the game's not actually over. And the game continues.
You get you get that way more with co-op games. You get people commiserating mm-hmm. afterwards. You get a conversation happening with everyone involved after the game is over, whether you won or lost. If you won, it's like, man, that thing that you did was cool and you totally helped us, and the best mm-hmm. thing that that happened was your thing. Yeah. Whereas in a competitive game, everybody's just like, yeah, good game, man.
Yeah. And even if they are lording over something and saying, oh, man, you had an amazing move, that amazing move is at the expense of somebody else on the table.
Yeah.
When it comes to negative feelings about cooperative games, they usually come down to one of two things. Fuck this game.
Mm-hmm.
Often because it just embarrassed you. Mm-hmm. And the other one is, fuck that guy. He's obnoxious to play cooperative board games with because he tried to tell everybody what to do every single turn. I'm never playing with him again.
Quarterbacking problem.
Yeah.
Where you got one person dictating actions for other players. And that's always a problem. That's what you really need with co-op games. You have to have an element of randomness so that that quarterbacker can't predict what's going to happen.
Agreed.
I mean, it kind of sounds like what you were talking about a second ago, Nathaniel, is about, you know, it's like a mission debrief. You know, at the end, even if you failed a mission, you failed the board game, the whole point is to talk to your friends and actually kind of go and figure out how to do it better next time. And I think that's a really nice aspect to it.
All right. Let's talk more about some booze.
Yep. Yeah. Oh, we're moving on.
One of the first ideas we had on this podcast was to go and give a eulogy to dead bars or dive bars that were some of our favorite places in this city. And I would say bars that were some of the reasons why we fell in love with this town to begin with. I moved here 14 years ago, and when I was 19, which kind of sucked for a while, one of the first places I stumbled onto and one of the first places I was told about to go to was the Tugboat. I was told the Tugboat was a nano brewery, which I thought, well, that sounds awesome.
That sounds awfully Portlandish.
So tiny.
Yeah. And, you know, even... you know, finding the place kind of tucked around the corner from Mary's Strip Club, kind of in a weird dark alley next to what looked like maybe it was an old power station. I don't know. So what was that?
Well, you know, there's certainly the parks nearby just around the corner.
Yeah.
Ankeny downtown. You know, it's interesting because we talked about Ankeny and you talked about the negative aspects of biking on Ankeny. I wanted to chime in because I was like, well, Tugboat was on Ankeny. But now Ankeny's dead to me.
Yeah. And so when I first walked into the Tugboat, it was this darkly lit place, a very small bar. You know, they had a couple of their own brews on draft. It looked like, you know, my grandfather's study. It was full of books. There were awesome booths in there. Oftentimes there was a live jazz band playing, and it wasn't that kind of place where you would go where you just thought, man, I wish this place was just quieter, because the jazz band always played at the volume in which you could appreciate the music and still have conversation.
I always felt that the Tugboat had this atmosphere of being a gentleman's study.
Yes, very absolutely. Much.
The tables, the walls,
well, the paint, bookishness, certainly.
The bookishness,
the board
David
games.
Attenborough quietly playing on the screen. The names of the drinks, the pleasant bartenders, the stools, everything about the place felt like I was stepping into someone's study. Even when it was loud, it was quiet.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I don't know how they did that.
Well, I think, you know, the key to the tugboat's charm is that it's had almost a living room quality. And I know that when I first became a regular at the tugboat back in the early 90s or mid 90s, I definitely felt like I had stepped into somebody else's living room and that I was drinking in their home. And when I became a tugboat bartender back in, I guess it was 2007, I tried to bring that to the front, that for me, the best aspect of the bar was the fact that the bar felt like you were drinking in somebody's home. And so for me, it was very much a matter of acting as the kind of host that I would be in my own home.
Well, I think that that mentality that you're talking about with all the staff that I experienced there really made me, I think it made it so no one wanted to misbehave there because it felt like it was someone's home. It felt like it was someone's study. It felt like these are all proper folk just going there to get a drink and just kind of enjoy each other's company, and you don't go and act unpleasant.
No, I mean, I can certainly say that in my decade working behind the bar at Tugboat Brewing, there were only a couple of instances where I had to actively eject anybody who was, guilty of malfeasance. In one instance, it was a little El Salvadorian guy who drunkenly decided he was going to spit on one of my musicians who was playing at the bar. That was probably the most physical I've ever been with a customer. I actively pushed him, his wife, and her brother out the door of the bar and into the puddle in the street outside and locked the door so that they couldn't come back in. And then I had a couple of instances with people who came in obviously already inebriated or dealing with other drug issues that I couldn't serve.
But it was that kind of neighborhood.
Very much. But it is not the kind of bar that tend to draw the sort of troublemakers that I think a lot of dive bars do draw.
And again, especially in that neighborhood.
In their whiskey. Well, certainly, yeah.
That's not the worst neighborhood. It's downtown. There are a lot of transients in the area. The park nearby is a little sketchy.
A little bit.
But I can think of significantly worse areas and worse bars. The tugboat, again, like it had its own, it had this flair to it. I can definitely see people walking in off the street and just being like,
nope.
Oh, yeah. Nope.
Yeah.
Yamhill's down the street. Yeah. There's Dante's over there. Yeah. Have a good night.
And you know, another aspect is because Megan and Terry Nelson, who owned and operated the tugboat during its entire run, they were kind of no-nonsense people. And so they didn't really deal or they didn't abide by anybody who would come in and use drugs in the bathroom or that sort of stuff. So they set up a very quick reputation of not allowing or not having folks come in and be problem characters, which I appreciate.
The other thing that I really enjoyed about that, too, is I would go there all the time with my good friend Eric Stern, who I think we were actually talking about before we started this podcast. Eric Stern, for those of you who don't know, is the was the head of Vagabond Opera back during its day. I was a member of Vagabond for a while. Skip Von Kusky, also the one was also the cellist of the band, who also went and made our intro and outro.
Oh, did he now?
Amazing.
Yeah. Amazing. And I believe Mark Burton, the drummer for Vagabond Opera, used to do some jazz stuff at the tugboat as well.
Yeah, very much. Mark was a regular in there, yeah.
Yeah, and so, you know, Eric and I would just go in there and for hours just play chess.
Yeah.
Because it was that kind of a bar where you could just go there, play chess, listen to good music, drink Chernobyl stout, get progressively worse at chess, but still have a great time.
Glenzel, when did you start working at the tugboat?
So I started working there in 2009, but I was a drinker there originally in 1994, 1995, and befriended the previous bartender, Sean Duncan, and the owners. And then I happened to be wandering around looking for work in the early 2000s and stumbled in and happened to have some Chernobyl. It was my regular. I used to come in every couple of weeks and have a couple of Chernobyl stouts. And at one point I came in and Sean leaned across the bar and said, "Hey, you ever consider working here?" And I was like, "Yeah, like every fucking time I've come in." And so lo and behold, I got a job there a couple of months later, and I worked there for the last decade.
I will also say, though, that macaroni and cheese that you had there,
pretty tasty.
It's so good.
You know, I ate a lot of that macaroni and cheese you as might have a staff meal. It, but
sure, but...
it's a little too much.
I mean, it was so rich. It had like, what, 4 or 5 different types of cheeses in it. And
it's very tasty.
I just remember like having many good nights of just being... I mean, because after you have 3 or 4 Chernobyl stouts, you need some comfort food. Something.
Did the tugboat ever export its beer beyond?
Never, never. So tugboat remained the smallest production brewery in Portland for years and years and years. There was a brief period of time where Captured by Porches, which was out of Clinton Street Brewing, that they actually produced less beer, as 2 barrels at a time. But then they moved into a larger location. So briefly, the tugboat was not the smallest brewery in Portland, and then it reacquired the title of the smallest brewery in Portland when Captured by Porches moved into a larger space. But it's always been, had always been a brewery that produced beer on site for service on site, never distributed its beer elsewhere, never sold kegs to people for parties, never basically allowed that beer to be consumed in any place other than on the tugboat premises or out of a growler.
Which again made it so special. And, was that if you wanted that beer, and again, the Chernobyl was,
it was
a true majesty of a beer to behold. Like, it was darker than the darkest night.
So dark.
It seemed like this would be the the darkness that would become Chernobyl after the entire area was evacuated. And what was it, like 11-12%?
13% is what they called it. And you know what? The interesting thing about the tugboat, I can say now that obviously it's closed up. You know, the owners of the tugboat who brewed the beer themselves, they never measured things. They were not the sort of people, because in this town now, the nature of the brewing scene is that there's a level of scholarship associated with brewery, a level of knowledge and experience that has a almost numerical quality to
it. What was your terminal gravity? What was the original gravity?
Yeah, and the nature of the tugboat was, we don't really give a shit about that. Does it taste good to you? If it tastes good to you, then I'm glad you're enjoying it, and nailed that's all it. You need.
Jacob, do you have any stories from the tugboat?
Yeah, I was actually in and out of the tugboat a lot. I used the tugboat. The tugboat for me reminded me of almost a down-on-its-luck gentleman's club. Much like what you're saying with somebody's study or somebody's living room, that was the vibe I had it. I used that for, and this is so like 180 degrees from what so many other people got out of the tugboat. I used it for sit downs when I had to have really hard conversations with people.
Sure, yeah.
Because it was a place where people could feel at ease, where it was really hard to make someone feel like they were boxed in or something like that.
Yeah, there's a level of comfort associated with having a beer at the tugboat that I feel like doesn't necessarily... It makes any kind of difficult conversation that you've got a little bit easier to deal with.
So, yeah, no, I negotiated a couple contracts there for my services. I sorted some other problems.
I had a number of first dates
breakups
there.
Yeah, you know, first dates.
No break. Well, okay. I oversaw the peaceful dissolution of a couple of people who were trying to figure out how to break up their partnership, business partnership.
Sure.
And they wanted a mediated conversation.
Hmm.
And I'm like, okay, we can do this. I'll even do it for the price of a bar tab. We're going to the tugboat.
Sure.
Because
sure.
It's hard to get pissed off at the tugboat.
Yeah.
Let's bring it up from there, though. Monday cheer.
Oh, Monday cheer. Hooray!
Hooray! Monday cheer was my favorite time to go to the tugboat.
Yeah. You know, the origin of Monday cheer, because I was working Mondays, Tuesdays, and Saturdays. Sure, I'll have a touch more. The origin of Monday cheers was that a lot of my friends, people who I knew personally, they had a tendency to come in on a Monday night because, generally speaking, it was a little quieter. It was more opportunity for them to be social with me and with each other. And they would cheer for one another as people came into the bar because they knew each other. But then I said, hey, guys, you know, it's Monday, and the nature of the beast is that everybody's a little bit under the weather on a Monday. Why don't we just cheer for everybody? Everybody needs a cheer on a Monday. And as a result, I managed to get a group of people who regularly cheered for people on Mondays. People come in the bar, and usually, you know, obviously the first people that come in the bar is just me cheering. But if I could get them under my wing and get them to cheer with me, then we could really form a little bit of a regular cheer. And it was a fantastic A, tool for getting customers into the bar on a Monday night. But B, it also was really invigorating and sort of illuminated the nature of that
time. Now, did you always boo, or did that come when people left?
The booing, so we would cheer when people came into the bar, and when people would leave the bar or act to leave the bar, we would boo. And that had mixed results. Now, the booing was always done out of love. It was always done as a way of saying,
you're leaving us. How could you?
You're leaving us, and it's sad that you're going, and so we're going to boo for that. And I had a couple of people who got upset about that. And at some point, thanks to Yelp and all of the ridiculous online reviewing, you know, it's so polarizing. It's like everything's 1 or 5 stars on Yelp. And there was somebody who was like, how dare a bar boo a paying customer? And as a result, the owner asked me to stop booing. And that was probably just a couple of years before the bar closed. And so we stopped booing. And the funniest thing of all was that I had a large selection of regulars who had gotten used to booing. And they didn't give a shit whether or not I stopped booing. They were going to boo people when they left, because that's how it went.
You're welcome.
Yeah, exactly.
You're welcome.
Yeah. You know, I did have a couple of interesting responses. I had one guy drop his pants when we booed him. You know, he dropped his pants and booed in the bar.
Yes!
Gave us foot sack and everything. I mean, it was hardcore. But, you know, and then I had on one instance a couple who really didn't want to be booed. They had staked a claim kind of near the door of the bar and waited. They finished their beer and then they waited and waited and waited. And then somebody came in the bar. And we all cheered, and this couple hightailed it out of the bar. So in the end, it was kind of like a situation where the door opened and the bar went, yay, boo! And it was kind of a... Actually, the best thing of all was the expression on the face of the people who'd come into the bar, whose reaction was like, what the fuck? Like, this is the most bipolar bar ever. You were expecting something else? You booed for us and you cheered for us? I don't understand.
Make up your mind!
Yeah.
I've never had an experience like that at any other bar.
No. Well, you know, it was very much couched in the sushi bar. You know, when you walk into a sushi bar and the sushi chefs kind of holler out, it's not itadakimasu, but they say some other welcome. I felt like there was something joyous about that greeting, and I really wanted to embrace that.
It felt like cheers.
It was. You know what? It's very much like where everybody wants to know your name.
Yeah.
Although so many times people came into the bar and you cheer for them and they give you a look like, did I win something? And I'm like, you won our company.
You're welcome. You're welcome. You're welcome.
I will say that I took more than one person into the tugboat without warning of them of that on Monday.
Crucial.
And made sure they were the first people through the door.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you bring someone new there on a Monday, you push them in front of you.
The flip side of that coin is that occasionally I get a situation where the door would open and the bar would cheer and somebody would step in and then they'd smile knowingly and turn around and leave. They come in just to get cheered. Fuckers.
Yay!
No cheers without buying beers.
Yeah.
No cheers without beers.
The situation where somebody gets booed upon leaving, and then after they've exited the bar, they turn around and come back in to try and get a cheer, and I was wise to that.
Oh,
no.
You're playing with fire, mister. Don't toy with me.
So tell me about your choice of visual entertainment.
So when I first started working at the tugboat back in 2007, the tugboat had behind the bar a beautiful old analog neon clock. It sat above the bar. It was a fantastic old piece. I don't know where they got it, but it had been up there for years and years. And after working there for about a year, I came in one Monday morning and the clock was gone and had been replaced by a television. And I was terrified because the last thing I wanted to do was work in a bar where there was sports on the TV all the time. It's like every bar in Portland. I feel like if you want sports in a bar in Portland, you could fucking find it. It's no problem.
Not just that, but most bars that you go to that have a TV have 12 TVs, which means that there's nowhere in the bar that you can sit where you're not distracted by a blinking
Buffalo
box.
Wild Wings syndrome.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's like
the worst.
You can't not face something that's of distraction. Yeah. And so when the owners told me about this television, when I saw this television, I said, well, what are we going to play on it? And they said, well, how about nature videos? And I said, I am in, because I have a large selection of fantastic BBC nature documentaries that I have acquired over the years, you know, going back from Life of Birds and Blue Planet to Planet Earth and all of these other more new stuff. And I had a real tendency to bring those in and screen them. And I even got to the point where I was rescoring nature videos with different audio and playing those versions up on the board so that when the shark would come up and attack the seal, the Jaws theme was playing.
I went there a lot more when I lived on the west side of town, too.
Certainly.
And what I really, really enjoyed was just going there on a rainy night and just kind of staring out the windows and looking at things passing by and then just slowly slipping on a Chernobyl stout. Mm-hmm. I mean, just because everything, I had a rough couple of years when I first moved to Portland. And I felt like at that moment at the tugboat, everything was just kind of right in the world. You know, I could sip on this beer slowly because it was so strong.
Yeah.
And, you know, just watch the rain come down. Just enjoy the world passing by me. So that's one of the things that I really appreciate about your bar.
Yeah, it was very much a stalwart from the old Portland days. You know, when you think about Portland from the 90s, it's very different, obviously, than Portland now. And I felt like the tugboat was one of those establishments that really helped define Portland in the 90s.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. And as a result, when it went, it was painful for me. It was very difficult because it felt like not only was I losing something that was defining for my own identity, but also I was losing a place that I loved. And in addition to that, it was a place that I felt helped define the city that I love. And the loss of the tugboat and the loss of a lot of other wonderful dive bars in the city, I feel like has really driven or has in many ways been symptomatic of Portland's change to a more, what I think of as a more Californian model, or certainly a very different kind of model.
I mean, there was a bumper sticker that I brought up last podcast, which I saw the other day, which I loved, and it just said, make Portland shitty again.
Yeah.
And
not going to happen. There are so many developments popping up everywhere now.
Have you guys seen the dive bar t-shirts? They're fantastic. It's a t-shirt that's got on the front of it a whole bunch of bars that have been closed down in the last 5 years or so. And it's got a big picture of a diving figure with a cross through it, you know.
No doubt.
And on the back it says, nice condo. I used to drink there.
When you started that sentence, that paragraph, I should say, I was about to just cry.
Mm-hmm.
Because it sounded like such a commercialized shirt. Dive bar, yeah. However, that punchline, I want that shirt.
It's now. Really
nice condo.
Good.
I used to drink there.
Yeah, nice condo.
Actually, I think it's nice condo. I used to get drunk there.
I like that even better, actually.
Yeah.
But they're not even condos. They're high-rent apartments with no parking.
Well,
anyway.
Yes. We've been there.
Folks, we're running high on time here. And I want to give a proper send off to the tugboat.
Yes.
There have been numerous articles posted on it.
Yeah.
There were many of which quoted you.
Yeah. You know, it's weird is despite the fact that I have never been an owner in the bar, had any kind of stake in the bar, I very much was the face of the bar for a lot of people. A lot of people would come into town from out of town and they just assumed that I was going to be the guy because I've been there.
Well, listeners, if you know of any place similar to, we're looking for a tugboat replacement.
We're looking for a tugboat replacement.
I don't know if it exists.
I don't think that
but
it does.
We're definitely eager to hear from you if you know of one.
Yeah, I need a job. If you want to hire me for your tugboat replacement, I'll totally take
everyone it. Everyone should hire Linsel. Linsel is great. He is a wonderful human being.
Well, that's definitely bartender. Not true, but I am a pretty decent bartender.
Well, he is a wonderful bartender.
The tugboat, we salute you.
We salute you indeed.
You were a great place for fantastic conversations, for
great music.
Great music. You always felt welcome, and they were genuinely sad to see you go. And the tugboat, we're genuinely sad to see you go.
Here. To the tugboat.
This is the last call for alcohol this evening. Drink up, drink up, drink up, and order again. This is the last call for alcohol, get going. Drink up, drink up, drink up, then order again.
Well, we are closing this out here. We have actually switched to our third port, which is, I don't know how to, Kopke?
Kopke, I believe. Kopke
20-year tawny port.
This is the old classic. It's been around for a long time. Good.
There's literally no information or clever writing or anything enticing written on this bottle other than its name and its age.
The nature of Kopke is they've been around for long enough that they don't need to write things.
And I must say, it's the best.
So good.
Of the three, this has blown my mind.
Yeah, it's delicious.
The moment that smell, I want a cigar. Just right then.
You gotta have a cigar.
Gotta have a cigar.
I mean, the only thing on here other than the glass on it that kind of is raised on here and the ink, which looks like it was spray painted on here, is the legal requirement that comes from the United States from a bottle that has to have be slapped on the back of it. And that's it.
Yeah, it's just got the bare minimum of information.
In fact, I want to take this label off just so the bottle looks better.
You know, Linsel, was the tugboat ever a smoking bar?
It was, very much, yeah. Wow. For my first few years of the tugboat, it was absolutely a smoking bar. In fact, over the heads of all of the patrons at the tugboat was an industrial smoke filter that was running most of the time. In the first few years that I worked at the bar, it was something I had on every single day because there were always smoking patrons at the bar. And it was the only thing that could keep the actual space from feeling smoke-filled. In fact, every day when I would come home, the first thing I would do is strip off all my clothes and put them in the wash because otherwise I'd take a shower because otherwise I'd wake up with a cigarette-smelling pillow, you know.
And if we have any listeners who happen to be in states outside of Oregon, I'm surprised if we do. But if so, you can't smoke in bars in Portland anymore.
Oregon. Not for a long time.
There's a number
of
states.
Very few exceptions. Yeah. You have a couple of cigar bars.
When did that law go into effect?
2006 or 7. I remember.
Because I think it was 8 or 9.
It was 8 or 9 because I was already in town.
Or 10 because Linsel, you were...
I was certainly working at the tugboat at that point.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think it was 2008 then.
I think it might have been
8 or
9.
I ended out being at the Yamhill pub right at midnight when the law officially went into place.
Oh, it was voted on in 8 and passed and then actually put into place in 9.
Yeah.
Right.
Because I remember New Year's Eve being at the Yamhill pub on the eve of the smoking ban being put into place. And then at midnight, they're like, all right, just kidding.
Yeah, Yamhill. I'm sure they didn't necessarily hold people to that.
The amount of shits they gave until 2:30 in the morning were about negative 10.
Yeah, you know, Yamhill Pump, really the last dive bar in the downtown.
It is. Yeah, I mean, they did their floors at one point. I was kind of shocked. And
what?
Yeah, they took out the
carpet. They cleaned off all the piss?
Well, they used to have carpet, which was...
Oh, my God. Bad idea. Yeah.
Vile. Yeah. We'll talk about that another time. Yeah, that's
right. What do you think of these ports, guys?
Wonderful
so far.
Really delicious.
Wonderful. Every last one of them was good.
You know, I will say that I think when it comes to port, I prefer port that has stencil as a font rather than papyrus.
100%.
Okay. I can vibe with that.
But that being said,
not Comic
all
Sans.
Of them were delicious. Really
yes.
delicious.
Each one was completely different.
Very
too.
Different.
Very
well,
different.
I feel like the nature of something like port is you have to taste a couple of different varieties at the same time so that you have something to compare it. Because otherwise, it doesn't really compare to wine in the same way.
I have almost no basis of comparison with port as it is. It's one of those that I'd always just sort of like push aside as being a dessert wine. But now that we've been drinking it as our drink, I'm a little sauce.
Oh, yeah.
And
definitely.
It's delicious stuff.
Yeah. Creeps up on you.
Yeah.
Tawny port are one of the few types of wines that I actually started drinking when I was younger and actually really enjoyed throughout my drinking years. So the fact that it was port night, I went, today I won't go starboard.
What is tawny port? What does that mean?
I hear Tawny Port and Ruby Port are the two ports that you tend to see, but I can't say that I know the.
Maybe we'll ask our wannabe wine snob at some point in the future when she joins us again. But for now, it's a mystery. Anyway, Linsel, it's been fantastic having you here with us. It's
a pleasure being here.
You are a wonder on the microphone, and I have enjoyed every moment that you've been here.
Well, thank you so much, Nathaniel. Same here. Pleasure.
Well, you've been listening to Biker's Dice and Bars. Again, I'm Nathaniel.
I'm Just Jacob.
Dr. Xander Gerrymander.
And our special guest tonight,
Linsel Green.
Thanks for joining us, Linsel, and thanks for listening to us. We hope if any of you have fond memories of the tugboat, please let us know. All of our information is available online. We are at bikersdiceandbars.com or at breakfastpuppies.com.
Breakfast puppies!
Drop us a line, leave us a review, and let us know what you think, and especially if you have any memories of the tugboat, one of our favorite departed bars. And as always,
Riverside down.
May your dice always roll crits.
Always drink responsibly.
And make sure to tip your bartenders.
Thanks for listening, folks. We'll see you next time.
Thanks for joining us, friend. We've reached the end of Biker's Dice and Bars.